You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
What's this button do?
You are now entering the green world.
Welcome to the latest addition to the Tuesday Wire Green World, a segment run by myself and BFM news teamers Leilani and Max. Green World will dive into the eco future, uncovering anything from niche research topics, strange and interesting tech innovations, and the latest environmental developments from across the globe. This week, we're talking about the first ever Overshoot Conference, which will take place in Austria, where climate experts from around the world will come together to discuss how climate targets can be recovered as we head toward exceeding 1.5 degrees of warming. New Zealand Climate Change Commissioner Dr. Andy Reisinger, who will be attending the event, says the global capacity to respond to this urgent issue depends on collective social and political will. Last week's UN Climate Summit also saw numerous political leaders speaking to global climate commitments, in particular in the lead-up to COP30, from U.S. President Donald Trump denouncing scientific evidence on the urgency of climate change, to Tuvalu Prime Minister Fileteteo calling for urgent climate action, and Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese calling for refreshed commitments to international cooperation on climate solutions. My first interview is with Dr. Andy Reisinger, in which we talk about the Overshoot Conference and global climate action. Can you talk a bit about the purpose of the Overshoot Conference and what kind of discourse or action you're expecting will come out of the event?
Yeah, so the situation that we're facing globally is that under the Paris Agreement, countries committed to limiting warming, or to try to limit warming to 1.5 degrees. And it's now clear that within the next 5 years or so, we're going to shoot past that limit. And there's no way left of stopping that. So researchers basically say, we need to talk about this. We need to talk about what it means in terms of the more severe impacts we'll be facing because of that, but also what it means for policies and actions to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Is it now all lost forever? Is there any way of getting back to that level, even after we've exceeded it, so then dial temperature back down again? And what would this mean in the near term and the longer term? And some of those things are valid research questions, and some of them are more a case of starting a conversation about some uncomfortable truths, so that we can actually collectively engage with that problem.
Yeah, there's quite clear scientific consensus that greenhouse gas emissions are continuing to rise and that global efforts need to be faster and stronger to mitigate the impacts. We're coming up to COP30 as well this year, which will be pretty critical in terms of generating these commitments on climate change. How likely is it, do you think, that nations are going to be taking their commitments and obligations seriously in the coming years before we reach a level of warming that has disastrous effects across the globe?
I mean, it's clear that we're not doing anywhere near enough to meet any of the commitments under the Paris Agreement at the moment. So if you extrapolate current policies being continued into the future, which in itself may be quite a hopeful assumption, then we're still looking at warming of 2.5 to 3 degrees, whereas under the Paris Agreement, we want to definitely keep warming to well below 2 degrees and ideally to 1.5 degrees. So it's clear that more action is needed. And in a way, that's a broken record that's been true every past year and will continue to be true for the next few years, I'm afraid, at least. What we are basically trying to generate as a conversation is that this is not a binary choice of, oh, no, we've lost it, and therefore now we just have to focus only on adaptation and it's too late to mitigate greenhouse gases. The evidence is very clear that every fraction of a degree that it gets warmer increases the damages from climate change. Every ton of greenhouse gas emissions that we avoid would avoid some of those damages, even though some consequences are by now locked in. We can no longer limit warming to 1.5 degrees. That train has left the station under our watch, and we weren't on it. So that's on us. Inaction has consequences, but it doesn't mean that all action is futile. And so it's trying to navigate that politically and societally quite challenging conversation about how do we go forward, while recognizing that it's not always 5 minutes to 12. The bells for 1.5 are tolling right now. Because, I mean, historically, there's always been, I mean, the world's been awash with claims of this is the critical decade, the next 5 years are critical, the next 3 years are critical. So in the rhetoric, in part also from environmental organizations, it's always 5 minutes to 12 in a hope that this will spur engagement. And I think on some issues, we have to confront the fact that it's no longer 5 minutes to 12. It is midnight. So how do we now handle ourselves in the time after midnight? That's really the conversation we need to have.
I wanted to bring up US President Donald Trump's address at the UN General Assembly this week. He made a bunch of claims on climate change, which are pretty shocking to hear. He calls it the global warming hoax, for one. He says that the UN statements about the consequences are exaggerated and incorrect, and that reducing carbon emissions costs jobs and is financially unsustainable. How concerned are you about the attitude he demonstrates towards the issue? And to what extent do you think that this has a negative impact on global efforts to address and mitigate the effects of climate change?
I mean, the short answer is everything he said was wrong. And of course, that's concerning, but it's almost not worth engaging directly. What certainly is concerning, and that's concerning simply as an authoritarian playbook approach, that you swamp your population with so many untruths and blatant lies that people just give up and get completely confused what's right, what's wrong, and it simply becomes, you know, a sea of opinion rather than actually some guideposts that are derived from scientific evidence. It's very clear that climate change is happening. Climate models have done an amazing job, a scary job, of predicting the rate of warming, the contribution of different gases to warming. And, you know, the latest estimate was the recent European heat waves last year caused about 62,000 premature deaths from heat exposure. Tell those people that it's not actually a problem. So it's completely unhinged. And that is, of course, a problem for the president of one of the most powerful nations, although, by the way, things are going that may no longer be the case in the near future. What we've seen is that basically no country has retreated after the US from the Paris Agreement. So if anything, the collective will to keep going under a collective effort, because it's the only way we can address climate change, has remained really strong. It will do damages to the efforts of some corporations, especially those based in the US, which are under direct legal pressure from the Trump regime. And of course, it has a spillover effect in the sense that people try to go about their business more quietly than overtly in order to, you know, avoid raising the ire of the Trump regime. And that's a problem in the sense that it will not necessarily help to engender the collective action that we need to accelerate current policies. It's not a question about keeping going. We need to further accelerate action. So yes, it's a problem, but it hasn't exactly destroyed climate action. It just has slightly shifted the tone by which people are pursuing their actions and their efforts.
How critical would you say is it that countries are increasing their financial investment into climate solutions and mitigation across the globe? And given the economic pressures, especially from individual national interests, but as well as like global conflicts or regional conflicts, do you think that there's any hope for compelling leaders to provide this financial support towards climate efforts?
I mean, hope does a lot of heavy lifting these days. It's clear that increasing climate finance is crucial. It's crucial to help people adapt to the impacts of climate change, to strengthen their preparedness for what's coming their way and what is already knocking on their doors. And it's also critical to increase climate finance to help everybody reduce greenhouse gas emissions where they can, because it's clear that there's a large potential to reduce emissions in countries that aren't wealthy, and we can't expect those to carry the burden where it costs up for an investment to do that investment themselves. So it is clear that we do need to invest in order to achieve the collective progress that we all want to achieve. What's the chances of that? I mean, in many cases already, renewables are cheaper than fossil fuels. So it's not so much about massive costs overall, but simply shifting towards investing in capital upfront investments in order to then reap the benefits of lower costs of electricity generation and substantially lower health burden. I mean, that's one of the challenges with coherent climate policy, is often that the benefits and co-benefits from a rapid transition towards renewable energy systems, but also towards more efficient land use, is that it doesn't quite appear as a benefit on the climate bill. It appears as a benefit on the health bill, on the public inclusion bill, on the protection of native biodiversity bill. And so there's a real challenge for governments, but also society as a whole, to actually appreciate the net impact of policies needed to achieve these changes. Again, what's our hope? We are seeing continued strong interest from countries in green investment and in clarifying the rules around green investment. In Europe, for example, there have been a number of quite significant legal cases where companies have been taken to court and lost for claims of greenwashing. And so there's a strong interest in clarifying how you define a green investment. But there's plenty of finance around that is looking for a good home to go to. So smoothing the path for that sort of investment is a critical element of enabling that finance to flow. Whether it'll be enough, I mean, given where we are, nothing is ever enough. But there's certainly a lot of potential to keep going in the right direction.
Over the past several years especially, I think a lot of people have become quite jaded towards the topic of climate change. Would you argue that there is a meaningful role for individuals and communities to play to combat these effects or to support global efforts against climate change, even as political leadership remains stagnant?
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard, right? If you look, you know, if I look at my own actions, there's always things that I could have done and I haven't done. You know, the fact that I drive an electric car still has negative consequences. Yes, I could take more public transport, but do I always take it, et cetera, et cetera? So it's a double-edged sword. I mean, in a democracy, ultimately, what leaders do, to some extent at least, reflects the broad public opinion. So the more the public can engage and sees for themselves a future that they want to walk towards, that will trickle up into political decisions. There is the downside that you can always beat yourself up for not being a saint, and therefore I'm failing, and therefore there's nothing left I can do. The American climate scientist Catherine Hayhoe keeps saying that the most important thing we can do about climate change is talk about it. And I think that's really true, and it's also true about overshoot, that we have to talk about what are we doing now that we're about to cross 1.5 degrees, what do we need to do to keep 1.5 alive nonetheless, in the sense of keeping the option open of returning back to 1.5 and limiting how much we exceed 1.5 degrees. All of these things, first and foremost, require engagement and presence. We can't always expect to land right away today at the solution that will get us there. There is no single solution that will work from today for the rest of the century. It's a gradual process. But sticking with it and engaging with it, drawing on the positives, finding communities of people that give you energy rather than sap your energy is a critical part of how you keep going and how you then learn from others and learn new things. I mean, the next thing on my list is that I want solar PV on my roof. I haven't done it yet, but every time I hear from somebody who's done it, that gives me a jolt and says, come on, Andy, you can do this, actually, now. And so it's these things, trying to draw the positive energy out of it is really crucial to help engage at a community level. And of course, at the same time, there's so many communities in Aotearoa, New Zealand, that are facing the consequences of climate change, whether you think of the recent floods in Nelson up in Auckland, still the aftermath of Cyclone Gabrielle, inundation risks in Westport, South Dunedin. All these communities, for them, it's very much front of mind. But again, the challenge is to turn it into an enabling environment rather than a disabling one. And that requires constant engagement, sticking with it, because certainly climate change will stick with us.
When it comes to a global response to climate impacts, UN Chief of International Development Achim Steiner has said that an observed increase of national defence spending has detracted from critical investment. University of Auckland Management and International Business Professor Sasha Mayer, who is engaged with research on climate finance, spoke to me about the financial obligation of individual states towards climate solutions. I was wondering if you could speak a bit to the existing gap in climate finance between what is currently being committed and what is necessary to combat the impact of climate change.
So there's definitely a large climate finance gap. And unfortunately, what we're seeing is that most of the money that is being spent on climate finance is being spent domestically. So countries are spending money, but keeping that money in their borders, which is fantastic for advancing domestic action. But there are a lot of emerging economies, developing economies, that don't have the resources and money to actually fund their own risk mitigation or climate change mitigation approaches. So they actually need finance coming from advanced economies like ourselves. So there's a balance there. In order to close the gap, the finance gap, we need to think about the areas in the world that need the finance and don't have the resources currently to actually reduce that gap, and then what can we do as advanced economies to help that, bringing into bear, we don't want to take any ambition away from what we need to do domestically.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Actually, this kind of trend of nationalism that we're witnessing in global issues, especially with climate change. This week we've seen it at the General Assembly, the United States talking about how the UN isn't really necessary or effective even, and that their calls for people to act on climate change are exaggerated and based on false evidence and that kind of thing. And I also had the example of increased spending, like Achim Steimer pointed out, that we're seeing increased defense spending across the globe. In New Zealand, we had $9 billion in new defense spending in this latest budget over the next 4 years. What are the consequences of this kind of internal or this kind of national trend that we're seeing, where we're not acting cooperatively to support poorer nations or nations who can't or who need support with cutting climate emissions? And what is the consequences of that, I suppose?
I think we need to look at where emissions are going and where emissions will come from. So currently, around about 70% of emissions come from emerging economies and developing economies. If you take China out of that picture, that's 38%. So that's still quite a large amount of emissions. Many of these countries just simply do not have the resources nor capacity to actually decarbonize. So how are we going to help out? You know, should we help out? What's the responsibility that we have? And I think that's really having a look inside and thinking about, you know, what options we have. And as I said before, it's really important that we do not at all take attention away from what we need to do domestically, but we need to balance out and think about that this is actually a global picture and the atmosphere has no boundaries. So where and what should we do? I think that's a conversation that New Zealanders need to have democratically. In terms of thinking about a trade-off between, you know, what you do externally and what you do internally, again, that's that sort of bifurcation of the argument leads us into an area of being for and against when we actually need to see that we need to work cooperatively. And this is not just about a problem related to reducing emissions and, you know, making sure we meet the Paris Agreement. It's actually also about democracy and actually thinking about the multilateral system and how important it is, particularly for small countries such as ourselves, to have that functioning really well. So we need to be cooperative. We need to be a role model of cooperative governance and not turn internally. But it's good to continue to look internally and to think about domestic action and not let that also be reduced.
Yeah, I think there's a role for both domestic and global or more cooperative policies that'll be necessary to address climate change. Why do you think that there hasn't been such urgency from political leaders to kind of step up? We're seeing, I mean, the example this week with the Overshoot Conference, where kind of there's a pretty broad consensus that this is an urgent problem, that we're not doing enough, that emissions are still rising, and that there is just not enough investment being put into climate solutions or into climate action generally. Yeah, why do you think leaders have been quite dismissive or more focused on national interests in this space, despite quite clear evidence that we're seeing from this?
Well, the evidence is scientific. It's only when, you know, you have those climate impacts, that those climate impacts, like flooding, for example, translates into heightened public awareness around that this is actually attributed because of climate change. And then citizens actually putting pressure on political leaders to say, hey, this isn't good enough. We need to do something. And this isn't just about the fact that, you know, New Zealand has a small carbon footprint. We don't really contribute. What difference does it make? It's actually really important that New Zealand is a role model. So we've got an opportunity here, like other countries, including Denmark, who also have a very small global footprint, to actually show other countries in the world what can be done. So, you know, this is not about stepping back. It's actually taking, this is an opportunity to take some sort of a leadership role. You know, you've got to remember that politics is politics. So it still really requires us citizens to watch politicians and political parties and to make them accountable. That's a functioning democratic system.
Coming into New Zealand a bit more, do you think that we're doing enough to support the Pacific Islands on the climate front?
I think that in terms of the Pacific Islands, there's always more that can be done, without a doubt. I mean, generally, but with adaptation concerns, but also thinking about how they could also, we could help finance their decarbonisation as well. Absolutely. But I think, you know, responsibility is beyond just regions as well. So there are other regions that have also don't have money that, you know, we should be responsible for, given the fact that we are a stronger economy than a lot of these other economies. So I'm thinking about Southeast Asia here in particular.
Amidst all of these challenges, I suppose, that we're facing on a global and national level with relation to the mitigation of climate impacts, how do we go about centering climate justice and kind of recognizing that the experience of climate change effects are felt differently across different countries and populations and groups? And
climate justice is absolutely integral to climate change. And I mean, science is very important to have robust science, but we've got to have the political conversations, because if we separate out inequalities, historical issues like colonization from climate change, you're not going to actually solve climate change, because all your solutions that come out to supposedly address climate change could actually exacerbate inequalities. Okay, so we could actually see the situation, at least for many people, getting worse. Climate change, addressing climate change, this is about minimizing harm as much as possible to humans and non-humans. You know, so we need to remember what the purpose is of climate action.
What would you like to see in this space in the next 10 years or so from our government to demonstrate a concerted effort, I suppose, in the urgency of our climate response?
One word for that: leadership, which I currently do not see at all. We need to see climate leadership. That means actually standing up and saying, hey, you know, we aren't a huge contributor. We've historically contributed a lot, but yeah, currently we don't. But that's not the point. The point is that we've got an opportunity here to be a role model. We're an advanced economy and we've got a lot to give in cooperation. So now's the time for New Zealand to really step up.
That was University of Auckland Professor Sasha Mayer and Climate Change Commissioner Dr. Andy Reisinger on the Overshoot Conference and the future of global climate action.
That was The Green World.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/becasts.